I'm going to call the Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Special Committee to order. And the time is 11:19. Present today, we have Representative Higgins, Representative Pruitt, Representative Herron, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Hughes. And we are may have, as usual, some coming and going. And one of the things, we will see how it goes. I don't want to promise that we're going to get out early. But I know there are other things going on over the lunch hour, and it's possible that we might be able to let you go a little bit before the normal end time. So we're going to hear today from representative from three areas, the resource industry, the tourism industry, and transportation industry. And we'd like to see a little bit how all these three overlap. So we'll hear a little bit about them individually, and then we'd like to talk a little bit about how they intersect. And so we're going to have a panel of all of them afterwards. So we're giving them each 10 to 15 minutes to give an overview of their business. And then at the end, again, we'll do a panel where we can ask some questions and answers. And we can ask questions along the way as well. So we're going to start first. Our first individual panelist is Lorelei Simon. And she is not here in the room, but she is on the phone. And she's a dynamic speaker, so I think she'll be able to maintain our interest over the phone. She's the Vice President of External Affairs for Usability Coal Mine. And we will operate your PowerPoint slides. Lorelei, are you there? You want to state your name for the record and begin, please?
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Lorelei Simon. I'm the Vice President of External Affairs for Usability Coal Mine. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the invitation to present to the committee today. I do apologize for not being able to be there in person, but I do want to thank you and your staff very much for helping coordinate and certainly for helping advance my slides. So we'll get right started, and please just interject whenever you're ready, and I'll try to speed through so I make sure I give the other folks good time as well. So on my first slide, UCM history, I really welcome every opportunity to talk about our company because we really do have a great story to tell. Usability is the only operating coal mine in Alaska. Emil Usability started the company back in 1943, and the company has been run by his son and now his grandson ever since. Joe Usability Jr. is our current president, and 2013 marks Usability's 70th year of operations, so that's something we're very excited about. Next slide, please. The slide titled Four Generations. This is just a nice picture of our company's progression. In the top there, you see Emil Usability with his son, Joe, and then in the bottom photograph, Joe Jr. with his daughter, Lexi. And that dozer is parked outside of our company headquarters in Healy. On the next slide, titled Coal Facts, I just want to quickly highlight why Alaska is so important to the global coal map. You can see that our country has about 25% of the world's coal reserves, but Alaska has about 50% of the U.S. coal reserves. That puts us on the map because while most of our coal is located up there on the North Slope, we do have a lot of coal reserves close to existing infrastructure. And if we looked at rail belt consumption of energy based on what we're consuming today, Alaska has about 1,000 years of reserves at current consumption. The next slide, I guess I can't talk about economic development without talking about the price of energy. As you all know, people need to be able to afford to pay for their energy costs, whether that's at home or for their business. This graph depicts the cost of electricity based on how much of that power comes from coal-fired power plants. You can see that Alaska is among the highest ratepayers because we are among the lowest users of coal. However, if you look down to the bottom right of the graph, you can see that Wyoming and West Virginia are among the lowest ratepayers, where they use 90 to nearly 100% of coal to generate their power. So as you, as legislators, deliberate Alaska's energy future, please remember that coal in Alaska is abundant and affordable.
Lorelei, I'd like to interrupt you just for a second. Looking at that chart and where Alaska is and knowing that we have 50% of the U.S. coal reserves, can you tell us how we got into this position? Just give us a little bit of history, why we aren't over on the far right, bottom right of that graph.
Well, I think the simple answer really is the availability of natural gas in South Central Alaska. Of the 6 coal-burning power plants in Alaska, they are all in the interior, and where most of our population base is in South Central, we've had the luxury of cheap natural gas coming out of Cook Inlet.
Thank you.
So the next slide, talking about economic development and jobs, I just like to, again, highlight the value of our company. We have about 130 employees, but my favorite bullet on this slide is the second from the bottom, where you can see that 37% of our workforce is second, third, and fourth generation employees. And I always like to point that out because you wouldn't likely encourage your daughter, granddaughter, or great-granddaughter to work for a company that you worked at if you weren't treated well, compensated fairly, and provided a safe working environment. On the next slide, further into jobs, I'll try to cover your three main topics of economic development, trade, and tourism in my presentation today. This is a list of only some of the positions that we hire at Youth Valley Coal Mine. You can see that some of them require college degrees, some require certificates or licenses, and some depend mostly on previous experience. One thing I think you all have heard about the mining industry is that we offer a wide variety of positions at good wages that can support a family. On the next slide, talking about economic development and lifestyle, one particular bragging right at UCivelli is that we provide year-round employment in a non-camp environment. And I'm sure some of you may be giggling a little bit at the term urban for Healy, and while it is remote, it's still on the road system, and it's easily accessible to the north or to the south. So being on the road system, our employees have the opportunity to live and work in the same community. Healy also boasts the highest per capita income in the state. I don't think that's coming from the seasonal tourism jobs, but it is coming from the coal mine. And, of course, we always like to point out that the average annual wage in the mining industry in Alaska is $100,000 a year. On the next slide, talking about economic development, you also have to talk about new projects. It's been fun to highlight UCivelli's operating mine in Healy, but I'd also like to take a little bit of time to talk about Wishbone Hill. As many of you are aware, UCivelli is working to further develop the Wishbone Hill mine north of Palmer. This is an exciting project, not just for our company, but also for South Central Alaska, because it could be the only operating mine in the region. And that, at least initially, right, because there are other projects under exploration in the Matanuska coal field. A key point to remember about Wishbone Hill is that it's located in a traditional mining area, and the project has been completely permitted since the 1990s. So while public interest in the project has seen a resurgence, the truth is this is actually a pretty old project. For one reason or another, the project just hasn't been fully developed. However, UCivelli is working to keep the leases and permits up to date with the hopes of further developing that project soon. On the next slide, just a couple more interesting facts about Wishbone Hill. I mentioned the value of Wishbone Hill to South Central Alaska, particularly to the Matsu, but here are some of the highlights. You know, this is 75 to 125 full-time, year-round, good-paying jobs, again, in a community environment where people have the opportunity to live and work at home. And it's money that stays here in Alaska's economy. Another point that UCivelli is very proud of at our mine in Healy, as well as at the Wishbone Hill operation through our exploration program, is that we work a lot with local vendors and contractors. So it isn't just the few UCivelli employees working in the Matsu region on this project, but it's also all of the local vendors and contractors that we're able to give business to.
Lorelei, I'd like to ask that Are you facing any particular hurdles right now that you are you trying to get around before you can move forward on Wishbone Hill? And then in that regard, what are some of the most common misconceptions to communities about a coal mining project? I live near where Wishbone Hill is, so I've heard some things. So could you kind of...
Yeah, thank you. Well, I would say that right now we are working through a permit renewal with the State of Alaska Department of Natural Resources. It is a permit that we have had. This is our mining permit. There are a handful of permits that go with the project, but the main permit we're working on right now is our mining permit renewal, and it comes up for renewal every 5 years. You know, I hate to use the term bureaucratic red tape, but I think it's something that you are all familiar with, and it really just becomes a process. We are playing by the rules, we're following the law and regulation required of us to have that mining permit and to go through the permit renewal process. The Department of Natural Resources is asking us for a handful of additional items, and we are working with them on getting that information. So I hesitate to give you a timeline, but I would hope that we would see a permit renewal sometime this spring or summer. And then as far as misconceptions go, I think certainly for this region, mining isn't something that people are too familiar with, because other than the gravel operators, there isn't a local operating mine. And while it's more common maybe down in Southeast or certainly up in the interior, it isn't something that's common dining room table conversation here. I know that there are certainly the environmentalist groups that like to perpetuate their agenda, spread a little bit of fear and anxiety in the community, but I always love pointing to Healy, Alaska. We can talk about Appalachia or other regions of this country or the world in other coal mining operations, but why would we do that when we can look at the only operating coal mine in the state of Alaska? And it is an excellent example of how there are very comprehensive laws and regulations in our state that are aimed to protect public health and the environment. And so if you take that model and implement it here, even though some of the mining practices would be much different, you know, it's hard to make a direct comparison between the Healy operation and Wishbone Hill, because they are very different. Wishbone Hill will be much smaller scale, that kind of thing. We do believe that Used Valley Coal Mine has an excellent reputation in the state, and we look forward to bringing those qualities to the Matsu region.
Thank you.
On the next slide, coal industry jobs. While the coal industry in Alaska is small compared to other industries, it still has a very positive economic impact on the state. You can see here a good estimate of direct jobs because of the coal industry, not only at the mine, but also within transportation as well as at the power plants. On the next slide, kind of getting into more of the committee's focus on the state's trade or exports, you can see just a brief history of Used Valley's export numbers. While we produce about 2 million tons of coal each year, about 1 million of that is exported, and we have customers in Chile, South Korea, and Japan. You can see the decline in export sales from 2011 to 2012. Unfortunately, that trend is likely to continue into 2013 due to an abundant supply of cheap gas on the market, as well as cheaper coal coming out of other countries such as Australia.
Well, Laura,
the next slide. Yes, ma'am.
How do those amounts of coal translate to dollars?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I'm sorry.
Well, for 2012, 2 million tons were exported. Is that what I'm reading?
No. We produced about 2 million tons in 2012. About 1 million of that stayed in-state, and about 1 million of that was exported.
Okay, I see that at the bottom. I'm sorry. So I was wondering, in dollars, then, the 1 million exported, what would that translate into dollars?
Well, I guess my short answer on contracts is that each of our contracts varies with depending on the customer and their needs, whether it's tonnage or various things. But it's also important to remember that in Alaska we do pay taxes as well. I would have to get detailed information for you, Madam Chair, on taxes and royalties and things like that we pay to the state. While the mining industry, it's certainly nothing like what the oil and gas industry sees, we still do have an impact on state coffers.
Okay, thank you.
And then on the next slide, you know, we talked about export news. On the next slide, I just wanted to give you the list of those six coal-burning power plants in state. So 1 million tons goes out on the export market. Another 1 million tons stays in state, used domestically. You know, I just want to point out, please remember that slide I showed earlier on energy prices based on coal. And I do want to take the time to say that the new combined heat and power plant at UIF will be able to take advantage of the least cost fuel source available today, and at the same time, that plant will be able to help reduce some of the problems they have up there with air quality standards. And then that last bullet there highlights the Healy Clean Coal Project, which should be coming online within the next few years. So that plant would be a new customer for Yusu Valley. On the next slide, it's just a quick graph showing you on the export numbers where it goes. You can see that Chile is our largest customer. Korea is our second, and then our smallest customer on the export market is Japan. So trying to move quickly for you, Madam Chair, the next slide is a photograph of the Seward Coal Terminal. You can see the coal stockpile in the middle close to that right edge, and then the conveyor system is what runs out to the ship loading facility. In the next slide, this photograph gives you a good idea of the size of a coal ship, which holds about 75,000 tons of coal, and how that size compares maybe to one of Ralph's cruise ships. It's also an excellent example of how the coal industry and the tourism industry can coexist. You can see three cruise ships docked right next to the coal loading facility. In addition, there's the small boat harbor right there, and then the campground along the beach. We have been exporting coal out of Seward for about 30 years. It is safe to say that the cruise ship industry grew up around the coal loading facility. And then finally, on my last slide, talking about tourism, please remember that our coal mine is located at the edge of Denali National Park, which is one of the most sought-after tourist destinations in the world. And remember that we've been operating there for about 70 years. There are many local small businesses that operate in the area. Some are seasonal. Some cater to the year-round residents of Healy and the surrounding area. Many of the seasonal workers in the area are employed by the tourism industry. But again, those are not the jobs that are paying an average of $100,000 a year. We actually do get quite a bit of tourists that come to the mine looking for tours. Unfortunately, we've had to significantly limit those tours due to their popularity. I mean, of course, anyone who comes to Alaska, they're naturally going to want to take a tour of an operating coal mine. But we have to remember that our primary business is to mine coal rather than give tours. However, I will be putting together a legislative tour this summer, so if any of you legislators, committee members are interested, please let me know and you'll be hearing from us as well. And with that, Madam Chair, my last slide is just my contact information. I'm happy to answer any questions now or wait until the panel.
Okay. I don't see any questions right now, so we will wait until the panel, but I just want to encourage members to think about one of those tours. I went on one last summer, and it is well worth the time. It's a day trip from Anchorage or Matsu, and it's worth your while, and it's pretty impressive, the reclamation and the work that they do. I believe that the Yusu Valley family really they're Alaskans through and through, and they care about our state, and they've been good stewards. So next we have Dale Wade, who is with the Alaska Railroad. So come on up and introduce yourself, and we'll look forward to hearing what you're going to teach us about the Alaska Railroad.
Down here, and slide right on through. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Brooks. I'm the Vice President of Engineering with the Alaska Railroad. With me is Dale Wade, our Vice President of Business Development, and on the line we should have Bill O'Leary, our Chief Financial Officer with the Alaska Railroad. And Dale and I are going to kind of bounce back and forth as we present things today. I'm obviously going to take the more engineering and infrastructure kind of related topics, and Dale's going to tackle the business environment and the economic opportunities that we have. There's some quick facts here on the Alaska Railroad. I won't go into any details on this, but we do have about 625 year-round employees. There are five unions that are members that operate on our property, and we move about 415,000 passengers last year. Dale?
Let me speak to the revenue sources. This is the 2013 projected revenues. Obviously, freight is the largest segment of our business. Our business line in freight is expected to be about $92 million next year, comprising 67% of all revenue received. The other business lines certainly are passenger business, 18% of the revenue source. Other, and then real estate is another $16 million, almost $17 million next year, about 12% of the revenue. And I'll get into more in detail later on that slide. Question?
Representative
Madam Higgins? Chair. Oh, that's a great number, 67% freight. Imagine what we could do if we hooked through Canada.
A lot more.
That's my point.
Good point.
Thank you. Continue.
A short history here. The Alaska Railroad was established in 1914. Construction was complete in 1923, and the purpose that Congress had when they authorized the Alaska Railroad was economic development. We are still in that game, and the Alaska Railroad operated as a more or less independent authority with the federal government until 1985, when the state of Alaska bought it and set up the current authorizing act for the Alaska Railroad. The state paid $22 million to the federal government and also contributed about $10 million in operating capital at that time. And since then, the Alaska Railroad has operated on its own without any further funding from the state for any kind of operating funds.
Let's take a look at the freight services and a little breakdown of where that 67% of the revenue comes from. Certainly, there are about six different segments. Oil field services, everything that moves onward from the lower 48 or Anchorage to Prudhoe Bay through Fairbanks. Petroleum products, which of course is Flint Hills refinery that ships products both north and south from the North Pole refinery. Large presence in and activities in the military environment and movement of goods to and from Alaska and within Alaska. Usabelli Coal is a large partner with us, and we move coal on a daily basis out of Healy north to Fairbanks for the coal or the energy production up there, and south down to Seward for export. Tofsi Coffsy, I'll explain that one. Tofsi stands for trailers on flat cars. Coffsy is containers on flat cars, and they are slightly different. Trailers on flat cars is our ability to move goods in fully loaded trailers. We lift the trailer from the LTL or full load trucking company. We lift them, secure them to flat cars, and then transport them from Anchorage to Fairbanks for delivery to final, either north to Prudhoe Bay or the final areas outside of Fairbanks. That's important because it takes traffic off of the road, and of course it's also a very green initiative in that you can move tons of freight for a much lower cost per ton by rail than you can on the road. Gravel?
Representative Pruitt.
I want you to just go a little bit more into that, because I think it's important to explain, having been in that business myself, help clarify, if you guys didn't do that, what would the change in traffic on the road be? What, you mentioned green. Can I have a little bit more detail, maybe? I mean, what would be the dynamic that would exist if you guys were not moving all the containers or the trailers through the rail belt area?
Certainly. There are really three things that I could speak to. First of all, there's, let's say, about 100 trailers per day that are moving on the railroad versus, and that may be a little high, but about 100 trailers a day that don't need to go on the highway system that can ride on the railroad. What it certainly does is takes traffic off of the roadway. It reduces the wear and tear on the roadway. And additionally, during the summertime, when there's a concentration of tourists that operate here in Alaska, certainly moving heavy vehicles off of the roadway onto the railroad is a benefit to all industries. Additionally, there's a unique economic environment advantage in using rail traffic, and certainly we see this extensively in the lower 48 on what they used to call piggyback, and that's the ability to move goods efficiently. We could pull a 100-car string of trailers in 12 hours to Fairbanks, and that takes a tremendously longer time to do. So as you get in a large project movement, it's really the only economical way to move massive amounts of volume in a relatively short period of time. It also helps the trucking companies to balance their workloads if they were to get either equipment or drivers and personnel out of sync. We can move those goods up there and help them with that aspect of their business. Containers, I didn't mention containers on flat car. Containers are the goods that come off the barge system primarily. And again, same thing, only they're not on chassis or wheels. And I've got another slide to share later. Good?
Continue.
Gravel and intermodal, and I'll touch on intermodal later. Gravel simply, of course, is the mining industry on the gravel side, and there's about 2 million tons of gravel that moves currently within the system from the valley into the road projects. Freight, I'll give you just a short, quick breakdown, and I'll move quickly through the slides, Madam Chairman. You can see the bulk petroleum, the top line, is on a rapid decline off of Flint Hills. Has to do with number of factors, one of which is the jet traffic through Anchorage. Coal is on, local coal is on a steady, beautiful, consistent, slight increase. Export coal is growing nicely until last year when it had a downturn, as Lorelei discussed in her presentation. Gravel is on the decline only because you can only expand the Anchorage Airport so many times, and that is the largest consumer of gravel. DOT, as the road system becomes more mature, there's less gravel needed for major road projects, and that, of course, is the consumer of gravel projects, of gravel commodities. And then interline barge I'll speak to separately because we've got a slide coming up on that one. Here's a picture of the 2012 freight facts, 57,000 cars at 5.6 million tons, 67% of revenue, moving from primarily out of the Seattle market. But an important thing to note is our connection to the lower 48 by rail. You can load a rail car in Florida and move it all the way up to Fairbanks without ever removing the goods from the from a rail car. So it's a through system involving lower 48 Class 1 railroads, barge service, roll on, roll off, Seattle to Whittier, and then back on the Alaska Railroad from Whittier north. Thanks. Intrastate business, that which stays within the state. This is somewhat repetitive. We've talked about that a little bit ago. Scrap material, jet fuel, and construction materials are certainly large. Interstate, that is the Alaska Rail Belt Marine is a unique connection with one of the Linden Operating Companies called Alaska Marine Lines, and we occupy the lower deck of the barge. There are large, massive steel racks that allow them to put containers up above us and makes for a highly efficient means of moving goods from the lower 48 to Alaska. And you can see there's a seven-day transit every Wednesday it arrives, provided the weather doesn't get in the way. International freight, we also interline with the Canadian National Railroad. Goods come either from central U.S. or across Canada originating, much of the goods for the North Slope that originate in Canada come in to Prince Rupert, Canada, and then they bring the goods to Whittier, where we, again, roll them right off and go up to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Passenger service is a highlight. It's one of the enjoyable sides of the business where we get to delight passengers that visit Alaska as well as those that travel within the state as residents. We offer daily service May through September and weekend services during the winter. You can see our happy customers that live north of Talkeetna. It's a very popular area called the Hurricane Turn, and the individuals that live that lifestyle or have cabins in those areas rely on the railroad as their primary or only means of connection to the main highway system. So we're a very important part of that lifestyle for the Alaska community. By the way, flag stop, in case you're not familiar, it's a lot of fun. It's the ability to wave the flag and then wave the train down or tell them when you want to stop and get off. It's the only railroad in the U.S. that still does that.
It only works with certain trains.
That's true. And then finally, the summertime passenger business. The tourism industry is very, very important to the Alaska Railroad. We participate fully with them. Many of the people that ride the railroad during the summertime came off of a cruise ship and are going up to the world-famous Denali Park. You can see the trains there that we operate primarily north from Anchorage to Fairbanks through the park, south on the Glacier Discovery to Whittier and explore the Chugach Forest. We have partnerships with the U.S. Forest Service, and then the Coastal Classic, which runs on a beautiful run from Anchorage down to Seward. Here's the access to the park. We do have a partnership arrangement with the U.S. Forest Service. It allows us to provide service from Anchorage down into the Chugach National Forest. That's a great environment. It allows for expansion of two different operations that we're building. You can see the buildings and whatnot in the Denali National Park as well. But certainly there's a growing segment of our business is the Spencer Glacier Turn and that area towards Seward. Here's a little bit on the passenger volume. Again, you can see there as the economy turns, so does the volumes. The Alaska Railroad ridership on the blue line is on the recovery and moving up. We grew at about 7% last year, and we think that'll continue again this year. Finally, real estate is a very important aspect of our business and certainly critical to companies in Alaska doing business here. We own about 36,000 acres, much of that in high-value land in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Seward. And the port expansion of area of Seward is very important to the cruise line industries, barge operators that bring the containers in. Barges can't operate up the Cook Inlet during the winter, so during the summer months they'll run to Northland, for example, will operate into Anchorage. In the winter they operate in through Seward, and we provide that critical link from Seward to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and beyond.
Let's talk a little bit about statewide issues. We're currently working with DOT and others on the state rail plan, which should be completed later this year. We are very interested in the transportation infrastructure plan. Last year, we got some help from the legislature, which we very much appreciate. You passed a bill that will authorize us to extend our lease periods out to 95 years for our real estate leases. We haven't actually executed one of those leases yet, but there are a number of our customers that are interested, and it's going to help us over the long term.
Tom, on the rail plan, how many years does that project out?
I actually don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to get back to you. It covers a fairly long horizon, though. I think it's like a 10-year.
20-year?
It's a 20-year level.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And we'll talk a minute about our system expansion projects.
By the way, I would say 10 years isn't very far out, even 20. I'd like to see it at 50, actually.
We do have a couple of significant federal issues out there. Most of you are aware that we had a struggle to maintain formula funds from the Federal Transit Administration last year. We took a reduction from about $36 million down to $27 million, and we are that act is up for reauthorization in 2014, and we anticipate further struggles. So your help in that is appreciated. We also are faced with an unfunded federal mandate for positive train control. What that is a overriding safety system that will monitor what our trains and our engineers do as they operate trains to ensure there are, to reduce the possibility of human error. It is clearly an improvement in the safety environment, but it is also clearly an expense that the railroad really is not able to pay for. So,
Tom, is that an automatic thing? If there's an error, is it remotely controlled? How does that work, the positive train control?
As the engineer goes down the track, there's basically a supervisory computer system, and if he is going to do something that violates a rule or makes an error, it'll automatically make a brake application and slow the train down before he can get in trouble.
Okay, thank you.
That's an easy explanation for a very complicated problem.
Auto control for
this is not easy.
No, it is not.
Just a minute, Tom. Mm-hmm. Representative Pruitt.
If you go back, the $5 million plus in maintenance,
mm-hmm.
that's after the full construction you expect $5 million plus. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then follow up. So is there ongoing costs above the $15 million every year? Does that $5 million kick in just as soon as we're done? I mean, it looks like there's a gap between the deadline and, of course, when we're going to implement it. Are we starting to implement aspects of it before the final rollout in 2018?
Using a combination of internally generated funds for the railroad and some available Federal Transit Administration funding, we are starting to roll the project out now. We're doing what we can with the funding we have available. And that involves both improvements in our dispatch system and in the field, in the telemetry between remote locations in the field, like switches and the dispatch office. All of those, as we roll a system out, get placed in service and require maintenance. So as time goes on, we'll be picking up more and more as the system's built out. We expect full build out in 2018 at this point.
And then continued follow-up. Mm-hmm. Of course, the deadline is 2015. What are the ramifications of not hitting that deadline? Are there penalties? Is there something that allows you that opportunity to have that three-year gap so that you don't have to discontinue passenger service?
The short answer is the industry fully expects an extension of the deadline to 2018 because we're not going to be the only railroad that's not going to make the deadline. As written in law right now, in 2015, that will trigger penalties, and both financial and operating reductions on the railroad if we don't get an extension.
And then the final question is, the $5 million in maintenance, after you're through with paying for it, is it something that is going to hamper the current business model and the revenues that are generated? Is it something that's going to put a strain on the organization? I know right now, of course, with the freight is the majority of the cost. The passenger service is a small portion, and if $5 million is specifically for the passenger service aspect of it. At what point do we get to a scenario where passenger service, we go, I don't know, maybe that doesn't make sense. I don't want us to get there, but, of course, this is a federal issue. Not trying to slam the people that use it. My concern is I don't want to get to that point. And is this something that we're going to be able to sustain?
Let me address that, Representative Pruitt. It's absolutely essential that we maintain, that we meet the federal mandate, whatever that means. And by that I'm saying, as an organization, we're charged in our charter to support the people of Alaska, and that includes passenger service for those individuals. Additionally, it's a huge economic driver for the state, not only in those companies, that about the 430 passenger-related companies that booked tickets with the railroad last year, of which about 38 of those are, oh no, 83 of those are state companies, but those that we spend money on when we book zip line tours in Talkeetna, hotel rooms, all that other, the rest of the things that goes into economic development, support of the industry. Really looking at other ways, I mean, the reality is we need to meet the demand of PTC, positive train control, in order to run a significant passenger service. Discontinuation of the passenger service doesn't make financial sense. It currently spends more cash than that. It's cash flow positive. So we're moving forward with our eyes wide open as to how we can meet PTC compliance.
Okay, and I want to make it very clear, I am not advocating getting rid of passenger service. I just want to make sure we're having...
No, we're okay with that.
So I want to make sure that's clear.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then a quick update on major projects. The legislature has contributed funding to a couple of projects directly to the railroad and also to the Matsuburo in the case of Fort McKenzie. Just a quick look at those. The Northern Rail Extension Project is proposing to extend the Alaska Railroad the first third of the way from Fairbanks to the Canadian border. That would be to Delta Junction. The project's built, split into four phases, of which you've authorized some of the funding for phase one, which is a bridge over the Tanana River that the military can use once it's completed to access the training areas that you see on the map. The bridge is at Salcha. Here's a picture of it just getting started last summer. The river in the background is the Tanana River, and if you look across, particularly in the next slide, you can see the far bank and the work extending out. We expect to be done with the bridge in midsummer 14, and the military would start using it at that time. The second phase of the project would extend the railroad down to the bridge, and further phases would take it on to Delta Junction.
Question, it says year-round vehicle access, but it's only a rail bridge, is that correct, or does it?
No, actually, we've partnered with the military on this, and the bridge is going to be a bit like the bridge version of the Whittier Tunnel. There'll be both road and rail access for the military in the road case, so they'll be able to start using it immediately.
Representative Higgins,
and I don't know how to say this, but eventually, I would like to be able to see public access across that bridge into that area. You know, that's I know right now we don't want to talk about that, but since it's there, I know I've got a lot of constituents that would love to be able to get in that area to hunt. You know, so if we're going to have access to that area, I know the military's got access, but eventually I think we'll get there someday. So,
Representative,
of course, the military's throwing a good chunk of change in this. I'm going to guess that they may be asking for exclusivity. Is that something that's...
Well, from my understanding, we're paying for most of it. The state is.
The numbers are up there. State is contributing $84 million for the bridge, and the DOD is contributing $104 million.
They have a little bit. So, is that something that they would be concerned with?
Yes.
Yeah.
They've been very concerned about civilian access across the bridge.
So
that's their training area, and
we'll discuss this further down the road.
Yeah, no, it's not something I had to. Matt, appreciate you bringing it up.
And there's been a lot of attempts to make sure that we hire Alaskans and use Alaska companies in the job. There's a lot more information on this on our website, and the project also has a website, so the northernrailextension.com. Fort McKenzie is underway. We've been working through some legal battles. In fact, we just won another victory in court last week. And we have segments of the project out to bid with funding from the state through the borough, and more and more of this project is getting under construction.
Representative Tarr? Well, I guess go ahead and finish the next slide. I just have a couple questions on this project, but go through the next one.
Okay. It would be the fourth port served by the Alaska Railroad. It's attractive because it has such a large area for laydown and staging and future development. The piece that's near and dear to a railroad engineer's heart is the loop for large trains to come around, drop bulk materials like coal, and unload them and stockpile them and get them ready for shipment. We don't have this in Seward. It's a real opportunity to begin to move bulk commodities even more efficiently.
Are you going to do that one?
Go ahead.
Representative Tarr, did you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So just on this Port McKenzie project, so I've just received some questions from constituents about this one and just sort of some of the delays and the expense associated with it. And just curious, going forward, we just heard from the Yucca Valley folks, you know, if this project goes through, then this would become a shipping, you know, facility for the coal coming from the north. How would that affect what happens in Seward right now, and particularly given that the coal exports are on the decline?
Let me address that one. While coal exports are on the decline, our understanding is that they don't expect that to continue. That trend we expect will recover. There are a number of coal-burning facilities in foreign countries coming online, and so the demand for export coal will increase. And that's a great thing for Alaska as well as all coal mines. I would the intent is that we serve the businesses of Alaska, whether that be coal or gravel or any other bulk commodity. In the future, certainly they would need both ports, both south and north, Seward and Port McKenzie, to meet their demand for lift.
So you expect that they would, by the time this comes online, it would sort of sync up with when there'd be new coal development? Because my understanding is that there have been some layoffs in Seward as a result of the reduction in exports right now. So just wondering if they're going to see, you know, economic losses as a result of this project.
That'd be a great question for you, Sibeli.
Okay. Yeah, and when we bring everybody back, that's sure. Your question, so okay. Bring that up again. Okay, continue.
Thank you. A quick look at kind of moving from building brick-and-mortar stuff to more ethereal things. We have lots of people approach us about railroads to Canada, going west to Nome. We talk from time to time with oil companies and others about railroads to Trudeau Bay. All of those things come by us, and we absolutely participate in trying to get some of these longer range thinking projects up and off the ground.
Representative Higgins?
And you know why I'm an advocate of hooking up to Canada, mm-hmm. obviously. Well, in 2005, there was the ACRL project that was put together. It's been 8 years. Every time you go online, look at the updates on it, you know, there's not much. So are we doing anything with that at all anymore? I mean, is there talk still?
And can you tell us what the ACRL is?
Alaska-Canadian Rail Link.
Yeah, we have a strategic planner who's engaged in that. He's been to a number of meetings with the Canadian side of things. We continue to interface with that. Yeah, you want to?
Well, there's a group called G7G out of Alberta, Canada, that certainly would like, has, is asking their legislature for $10 million to do a study that involves the feasibility of running tar sands oil from Alberta across into the pipeline. You know, that was been in the news a little bit lately. Unfortunately, going across Canada is a very expensive railroad project. It would dwarf anything we've done to date. And though it's kind of a, we're not going to build it, so they'll right. come. Crossing across Tanana River is the first.
Right.
That's a military support project. If in fact we get to Delta, then we'll look to Canada to connect if they want to.
Yeah, from my understanding, they have to do, what, put 400 miles of line in on their end. We have to do, what, 600 or 700 on our end
yeah.
to make it work?
Yeah, I think the numbers are 300 miles for the Alaska Railroad to reach the Canadian border, and they have about 1,200 miles to build.
Is that because of their line that they do have is not the same gauge as what we got? I guess that's what I was told. They have a light-gauge rail, or we have a light-gauge rail. And
no, our gauge is the same as the Canadians. I think the light gauge rail is the White Pass and Yukon. I think maybe okay. where that's coming from. They have a different gauge.
So, you talk to different people, you get different numbers
yeah,
all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah. So. I have to spend some time talking.
I just want you guys to keep working on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in my lifetime it'll happen. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Good.
One point I did want to make on this slide is on the corridors to resources. In my experience working on both Port McKenzie and the Northern Rail Extension, I've discovered how extraordinarily difficult it is to assemble a corridor for transportation. You know, we're trying to put 80 miles together to get from Eielson out to Delta Junction, and trying to put just 32 miles from Houston down to Port McKenzie is extraordinarily difficult, much, much more difficult than I ever imagined. So I think it's important that in long-range thinking that there be some identification of corridors or more work in that area. The state rail plan is certainly part of the piece of the puzzle there. But also, you should look at the existing corridors, both rail and highway in the state, and make sure you do what you can to preserve and protect them. And because they are more and more difficult to put together. I think that's about all I had to say on this slide.
Bill? Okay. And then on the economic development partner side of the business, certainly we work closely on our intermodal interstate business arrangements with the Canadian line. We move a lot of, we are looking at moving natural gas. We've had conversations with a number of companies about that, not as our initiative, but of course on their part they are looking for ways to move LNG crude oil, refined oil, and we've had discussions with many companies. The upcoming project, certainly the Susitna Otana Dam, is a very, you know, a real project, and we've had many discussions with that. Future wind projects, we, you know, they've done two projects already, one on the island offside of Fire Island, and then, of course, Eva Creek, which was a major, wonderful project for us. Fun one we've got coming up this summer will be the MEA project. And I say fun in the sense that last year we had a good time putting together the windmills across from Healy. This year we're going to be working with MEA on putting a new power plant in, and they have got 10 of the largest engines that we will ever carry on the railroad, at least to date, topping the scales at about 1 million pounds, including engine and the specially designed cars that move those engines. So that'll be, again, another mega project. We do a lot of, we are really good at mega heavy lift projects, and we really have a good time. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. Is it something that, for the panel or specific to them? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Just wondering, two things. The update on the issues resulting from the flooding and everything near Talkeetna. I think things are moving along. Just curious about that. And then no mention of commuter rail in the plans. Any update on that?
I'll take the commuter rail segment. If I can be real candid, I'd love to do commuter rail to and from. The Alaska Railroad could certainly run that segment, and there's a number of good reasons to do that. Mm-hmm. Safety, economics, fuel burn, all those great reasons. Unfortunately, when you get them to the port, to the depot in Anchorage, mm-hmm. it's a whole other step to say, well, we're a mile from my office. How do I get from here to there? So to move that idea or that project forward, there needs to be a transit authority established of which the railroad would play a role. Mm-hmm. And we can certainly move individuals or commuter traffic from the valley into Anchorage, mm-hmm. so long as they can then connect with a network of systems. Mm-hmm. In every major city in the U.S., mm-hmm. In the lower 48, there is some mass transit system that exists, mm-hmm. and to support the continued growth of Alaska, certainly that's the right thing to do, mm-hmm. but there needs to be a larger overarching organization, like a transit authority, that can take care of that, you know, in whole.
Dale, absent of that overarching authority, do the economics work out, though, for it? Wouldn't it need to be subsidized? A commuter would have to pay an awful lot to make that pay for itself, wouldn't it?
Correct. Yeah, and that would be one of the roles of a transit authorities, as they can receive subsidies.
And I had a related question, but I was holding off for the panel because I was wondering how that could pair up with tourism and mm-hmm. And if that might help with the economic piece. But mm-hmm. thank you, gentlemen. We're running a little behind on time, so I want to invite Ralph Samuels up as our next presenter.
Okay.
You know the ropes, Ralph. State your name and affiliation.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ralph Samuels. I'm the Vice President of Government Community Relations for Holland America Line. And I'm giving an overview on tourism and travel patterns, and mostly they're going to be centered, the comments will be centered around travel along the rail belt, as it was with the railroad and usability. If you'd like another one at some future date, Southeast is a different pattern completely for tourism, for the ships, for the airlines, for everything. How it goes is a really different subject. So most of my comments are going to be basically on the rail belt, what people do and interact when they either get to Fairbanks, Anchorage, Seward, or Whittier, and how they travel up and down. And the first slide shows that some typical travel patterns that we've got. Either a ship will come up and go to either Seward or Whittier. Passengers will either fly into Anchorage or Fairbanks, so folks that are going to leave on the ships out of Seward or Whittier, if they're actually on a cruise or flying into Fairbanks, they do a Denali trip, hopefully. Some fly to Anchorage and just catch the train or a coach down to Seward or Whittier, hop on the ship and go back. You can fly into Fairbanks and fly out of Anchorage. There's all sorts of package deals that the various airlines will operate. But generally, that's the typical travel pattern that we've got. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our interaction that we've got with various other industries that we've got here. So about 60% of the summer traffic arrives by ship. And most of the rest of that comes by air. In the big scheme of things, a small percentage of the people actually drive to Alaska. So once you arrive here, you can do various things. You can buy a tour package, which buy on a ship, or you can buy Alaska Airlines vacation package of some kind. Travel the rail belt with your package. You can rent a car or a motorhome in Anchorage and kind of do your own thing. Or you can basically arrive with the ship through to Whittier, go to Anchorage, you spend a night in Anchorage at a hotel, and you leave, and really all that you've done, your cruise. Those are your three different options. People that are going to drive up, obviously they can have quite a bit more flexibility, but as I said before, if you're talking tourism in the big scheme of things, the volume of people comes up by air or by ship, the big volume of it does. Some of the interaction that we have is we talk about the traffic in the rail belt. What Holland America Princess will do, and Holland American Princess is a company that owns the rail cars, the coaches, and the lodging, whether the Westmark or the Princess Lodges. And we've got here is a list. We've interacted quite a bit with Alaska Grown, both in Fairbanks, in the valley. When we have menu selection, as the people that run our food and beverage operations try to develop menus that we think that the guests are going to like. The guests are always going to want to hear Alaska Grown, Alaska. Obviously, you see four or five breweries up there. If you go to a local venue, you're going to want to hear the local distilled vodka and all of the other things. The other thing is in addition to the agriculture, the seafood industry in Holland America, and this number is from I believe 2008. Just Holland America Line, not Princess or Royal or Disney or any other cruise lines. We purchased 265,000 pounds of silver salmon, 123,000 pounds of king salmon, 113,000 pounds of halibut, and 226,000 pounds of king crab legs. That does not include the shrimp. It does not include all of the other food that you have. So it's a large volume of people. They're eating, you know, we're trying to work with the local vendors for local grown things. The guests like it. It rates very well. When you ask people what do they like about coming to Alaska, they enjoyed having the local fare, the local salads, the local beers, the local seafoods, obviously. So we think we do a very good job with that. And like I said, that's basically a list of some of the vendors, and those vendors are just the rail belt vendors that we have. The other thing that folks want to do when they come here, and one question we get quite a bit in presentations is, generally speaking, what do visitors that want to come to Alaska, what do they want to see? And really poll after poll that we've done, marketing has shown, the state marketing people have had the same information, is wildlife, a glacier, and mountains, and in particular Mount McKinley. Now, I don't know if this for a fact, that our folks in Mount McKinley say only one in four gets to see Mount McKinley. If they're on a week-long trip, it's only a couple of days right there. In some ways, I guess you could argue that makes them come back for another other side of the gold ring, I guess. So, and I want to talk a little bit. Here's some local vendors that we've got also that we use just along the rail belt. This is really from the Talkeetna Denali area. And what somebody like Holland America Princess does is you get a lot of, you know, I guess a word on the street is we own the cruise lines own all of the flight scene and the four-wheelers and all of this. And we're a transportation company. We own coaches and we own rail cars and we own ships. Other than in Dawson, which is a very unique circumstance, way up in the Yukon, very small volumes, what we do is we will take our guests to these venues. Sometimes you'll put two or three together and you'll sell a package. So we're going to have a tour of Anchorage and you might stop at the museum and you might stop at the Native Heritage Center, or in Fairbanks you could go to the Morris Thompson Center and maybe out to Goldridge 8. But we're the transportation company and that's all we do. The locals provide the food, the beverages. They provide all of the various tour activities that that our guests go to see. And they're really, these folks are what people come to Alaska to see. They don't come to see, with all due respect to the previous speakers, they might come to ride the railroad, but they don't come to see that. They want to see Mount McKinley. They want to go on a raft trip. They want to go gold mine. They want to get hands-on experience on Alaska-type things. And we're always looking for, you're talking about economic development, Madam Chair, we're always looking and trying to work at new ideas of things to do. And I'll get into some of the, either in the panel presentation or after this presentation, over some of the issues that we face, which some are obvious and some probably not so much. I pulled these out of the McDowell report, which was just recently released. Total impact of tourism to the state, and this includes all areas, so you can pick out the South Central Interior if you want to have the numbers for your particular regions, or for Representative Herron, if you look out in Southwest Alaska, obviously a little smaller percentage right there. But economic impact to the state of almost $4 billion, which, you know, we get it. We're not the oil industry. We understand that. But it has a significant impact on there. If you talk about employment statewide, I believe it is probably 8 or 9% of the jobs are directly related to the visitor industry in Alaska. It comes out of the same report. The revenue to local governments, bed taxes, sales taxes, and the example I like to use is the Denali Borough. And in the Denali Borough, the bed taxes, it's a very seasonal, it's a 120-day season for all the various venues, whether you flew up on an airline and drove up to Denali, you showed up on a ship and you came up, you drove the rented RV up, you drove your own car up, all of the bed taxes for the Denali Borough pay for three-quarters of their services. There's a small severance tax for coal and for gravel. There's some state funding for municipal revenue sharing. So we have a big impact in that one. For the bed taxes in Anchorage, the Denali Center is paid out of bed taxes. Obviously, the local CVB, and a portion of that goes to city to offset property taxes. And I didn't see in the report, I looked for property tax revenues, and I've been trading phone calls while I'm in the back waiting for my turn here, is to ask if property taxes were included in there, and I'll get you that information once I get the answer from McDowell on that. Is the property taxes for a hotel or for Orso's and Brew House that are clearly tourism-related and tourism-driven businesses, are they incorporated in it? And I'll get that information from you when I get a chance. Revenue to the state, and you can see a list there. And once again, this is total, not just the rail belt. Total was just north of $100 million for the various things right there. And I just wanted to point out, I said, once again, we realize that we're not the driver when it comes to state. Are similar really to mining or commercial fishing is we have a lot of employment and we do contribute quite a bit to the local government.
Ralph,
yes.
I see there's a pretty big drop with the corporate income tax. What can you attribute that to?
And Madam Chair, I questioned that myself, and that's another question that I've got trading phone calls there, and I'll be talking to the Department of Revenue about that because it didn't look right to me. Okay. I mean, you could see it fluctuating some, and I don't know if there was a different methodology that they used for that because it seems like quite a drop. Traffic dropped from the first, well, actually, traffic dropped, but it didn't drop that much. Okay. So, and once I get that information back from either the Department of Revenue or McDowell, I will I will get back to the committee with that information. That was, it was a big red flag for me, and I said I've been trading phone calls with McDowell to try to find out.
And the other categories, based on the number of passengers, went down a little bit. I noticed the ferry system revenues went up, so more folks are choosing. Are they doing more marketing, or do you know why that's up when other things?
Madam Chairman, I can't speak to the ferry system. I think that I saw that ferry and drive traffic, which was combined in one of the reports I saw, has increased slightly, and I don't know if their prices went up, and it's a percentage. I don't know. Okay. I can't speak to the ferry system at all. Various partnerships that we've got as we go through, once again, through the corridor. Here's a couple of photos of our interaction with the National Park Service. The nature of our business, we interact with the National Park Service, with the state parks. Here's 60 employees volunteered their time to go work on some of the trails in there. At Copper Center, just south of Glen Allen there, at the Wrangell St. Elias National Park, there's a ranger who comes in every night, gives presentations to the guests on various topics. They rotate the rangers out, so if you're there for a couple nights, you're going to hear a couple different things, some on wildlife, some on flora and fauna, and some on just the area, the cultural aspects of the area. At the McKinley Princess Lodge, which is just north of Talkeetna, the state parks has an employee which is funded through donations to state parks, full-time on site there to do the same type of thing. The National Park Service in Denali, which is the great volume of employees that we have that are so seasonal, what they will do is they will also come in and give training to our supervisors on there on bear safety, on wilderness safety, and then additionally for all employees in the spring, they will have a community outreach meeting that they're part of to give training once again to all of the employees, some of them who are new to Alaska, some of them who are not, but they want to make sure that you understand that once you get in the backcountry, things that can happen. Local businesses will all contribute in there, and we're such a big part of that local community that we're pretty proud of the relationships that we've got with both the National Park Service, the state parks at McKinley, and the Wrangell St. Elias, and it works very well. Additionally, the National Park Service outside of Denali has programs nightly at the Visitor Center in Denali that our guests will often take advantage of. So the visitor flow that we've got, and once again, as I pointed out, we are a transportation company first and foremost. And of the 400,000 passengers that I saw from the last presentation from the railroad, Holland America Princess hauls 150,000 people ride the rail. You know, in some way, shape, or form. It could be Seward to Anchorage. It could be up to Denali. It could be a lot of different things, but about 150,000 of our guests do that. Additionally, Holland America Princess owns 170 motor coaches, and there's one other large coach company in the state, Premier. They've got probably 85 or 90, and then there's a couple of onesie-twosies that either bring groups up or small companies, the Magic Bus type things. But mostly, the majority of them are between Premier and Holland America Princess, and we've got on the roads in the summer, 260. Additionally, the rail cars that we own, that we contractually have a relationship with the railroad to pull our cars, that we do the food and beverage on, we own the cars, we do the bookings on them. We own 20 rail cars, and then on busy days, because you fluctuate on ship days, the traffic just fluctuates greatly. You know, a Monday might be very busy and a Tuesday not so much. We have 10 other cars that we contract with the railroad, that we pretty much control the car on certain days. On the other days, our competitors might do it, or Royal Caribbean might, or their vendor, Premier, might take the car. So the railroad owns the cars, and somebody contracts with them, and then I don't know if the railroad spoke to the number of the cars that they operate on their own. They also have their own passenger service in addition to us. We just use them as the pull on there is what we do. So the rail versus the motor coach, there's a lot of discussion on the PTC. Most of the rail cars that we've got hold between 72 and 88 people, depending on the configuration. And just for the HAP portion, just for the 150,000 people that we've got, it would take more than 50 motor coaches to take the place of moving that traffic down the Seward Highway, up the Parks Highway, and that's just us, and we are slightly less than a third of the traffic. So you can imagine the number of coaches and the pressure on DOT and all of the rest of it. And once again, just for Holland America Princess, between Denali and Anchorage in that corridor right there, on any given ship day, you'd have 30 more coaches on the road at any given time, hauling the people back and forth to either Seward or Whittier. So the railroad is a big part of our business, and then, and you set aside the just the logistics of that, but the marketing. People like to be able to ride a train for a while, ride a bus for a while, or ride an airplane for a while, rather than having one mode of transportation. It's a real selling point to our guests to be able to ride the railroad. And I want to follow up one thing that Lorelei talked about earlier, is that I have also talked to the chairman and her staff about doing a tour. Last year, Representative Herring was the chairman and took the committee, I believe, to Skagway and on to Whitehorse. And you kind of saw the back of the kitchen type nuts and bolts parts aspect. Plus, you got to see a tourist for a day. And if you've never been on one of the packaged things, it's way different than going camping in Denali, which, you know, I grew up doing a lot of. You drive up the road. But if you want to see how the logistics works, I've had conversations with both the railroad and with Usabelli about trying to put together a package, and we'll get together the days for you so you can see some of what happens in Talkeetna, how it works, all the pieces fit together. What happens in Talkeetna? Denali is the crown jewel of Alaska tourism, bar none. That's what people come to really go and see. So we can take the committee to Talkeetna. You know, there's a portion that will be on the rail, a portion that will be on a coach, a tour of Usabelli Coal Mine, and I'll work with Lorelei and the railroad at putting together the logistics of that. And if you've never done it, I would encourage you to do it. It's, number one, it's fun, but number two, you get to kind of walk in the shoes of the people that are, quite frankly, some of these people spend a lifetime to come spend a week in Alaska on things that we take for granted. And having conversations with those people is, quite frankly, one of the most interesting parts of my job. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, or you can ask the railroad the hard questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ralph. Representative Higgins.
Just a quick question on the bed tax. Have you found that to be a deterrent at all, or is it working for us?
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, any targeted tax drives up the cost of doing business. Okay. I mean, if you want to look at what government can and cannot do, if you drive up the cost of doing business and your competitors elsewhere have not, I mean, there are people that want some guy in Iowa or California or something, they want them to go to Mexico or the Caribbean or right. Europe or Canada or Banff or wherever it is they want them to go. And if you drive up the cost of doing business, and we understand that we use services, we understand that we use the roads and all of those things. So I would just say you have to be careful when you start raising the cost of doing business. Right. Depends on what your competition is doing. It's a tough animal. And the other question before we get to the panel is, I'm sure somebody will ask what can government do? And it may be slightly counterintuitive, but the transportation mechanisms that bring all these people up are ships and airlines. And I spent most of my life scheduling airplanes, and they're also mobile. You know, we just came out with our 2014 scheduled Holland America line for Alaska, so you're planning a couple years ahead. And Alaska Airlines is probably 6 or 8 months when they put out a fall schedule and whatnot, but you can just change. You can go to Denver and decide to need to go to Minneapolis, and wherever you're going to use your assets the best, it behooves policymakers, if I have land assets on the ground, it behooves you, because then I've got money tied up. Holland America Princess has about $500 million in assets on the ground in Alaska, between the hotels, the rail cars, the coaches. If it were 501, you're in better shape. If it were 600, you're in better shape. So policies, as you, and I don't have any, I'm not pitching a project or anything, but policies, if I've got $800 million tied up in Alaska, I'm going to make sure I fill the beds. And that's the policies that we would hope that would go forward. You want us on land assets, because airplanes, ships, even RV rental companies, you can change the paint job on the RV and say visit Florida instead of visit Alaska, and you change your business model. So it's not that quick, but it behooves the policies of the state to want the transportation company to invest more in land assets.
Thank you for that insight. And I'm glad I didn't promise we were going to get out early, because it doesn't look like we're going to. If I could invite Dale and Tom to come back up. And Lorelei, are you still on the phone?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm going to start off with a question and invite other members to think about anything as we close out here. But I am curious whether you all have regular contact in a formal kind of way, because you intersect as far as the transportation and there's overlap, whether you have any regular connections or you just happen to see each other in the hall here and chat. And then particularly, the railroad has a 20-year plan. Did Lorelei and Ralph, did you have input into that plan? So those are my questions.
Madam Chair, it's not my role at All in America to interact, but I can absolutely guarantee that we interact with the railroad, if not daily, it's every other day, both on the day-to-day, the guys that the working people that schedule the which rail car and the reservation system that put those people off that ship on this rail car. It's quite a machine to watch. The day-to-day interaction, we think we have a great relationship with the Alaska Railroad, in addition to the contractual arrangements for pull costs. And obviously, we've been watching the PTC issue. We have a lot of interaction, probably less so with Isabelli, but if you talk to the people, and this morning I talked to the manager of the Denali Princess Lodge, which is the largest hotel in the state, and I would say that our employee facility in Healy would probably rank as the fifth or sixth largest hotel, just where we house the employee group. So you've got a lot of interaction in the local community with Isabelli, with the borough, and I think in that particular instance we all get along very, very well.
I would say we're interwoven and can't be separated. I manage the contract and negotiate the contract between Holland America Princess, HAP. I do go to Seattle and meet with their headquarters offices. So, yes, and on an operational basis, it's a daily interaction with HAP. And, of course, you can't separate, really, the operation at the Isabelli coal mine from the railroad. So we have regular planning meetings. We exchange emails on a daily basis with regard to coal sales and how we're going to move that and how many trains this week we're going to run, when they're going to go, and whether they broke or not. So absolutely, we're absolutely linked at the hip.
Right, and I did expect that somewhat as far as the here and now and the daily operations. I was thinking more long-term, looking out at the potential and ahead. Is there discussions about things down the road, 10, 20, 30 years?
Yes. Yes. Many of the contracts are 10-year contracts.
Okay.
Because of the asset, the investment that's required has to have a sustainable life to it.
Okay. And then the other thing that the tourism overlaps with this one, with the railroad, and so my question is regarding what Representative Tarr brought up as far as a commuter line and the potential for tourism, bringing it, more tourists out. And I'm from Palmer, so our railroad tracks were taken up, and there's been a resolution by our borough and the city of Palmer that they want those tracks restored. And part of it is it's for economic development to bring folks out, and a large number of those would be expected to be tourists. So could you comment on that, please?
Yes, Madam Chairman. I will say that one of the fastest-selling trains we have is the Fair Train. So obviously there's a demand for tourists, for commuters between Anchorage and the Valley. I mean, we can sell that thing during fair season overnight. So, yes, Tom would be better equipped to answer the question about track removal in Palmer and the background to that. But certainly,
well, with limited time, we could talk about that, because that's a really small portion. But the idea of tying the commuter with the tourist industry, it just seems like that would make sense. Does anyone have any other question, Representative Herron?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ralph, I appreciate you bringing up that trip that this committee did in the last legislature. And I'd be very much interested in having an infrastructure tour in how the three entities work with our guests, work with residents, and the Skagway White Horse tour was invaluable for our knowledge, and of course we feel that we were part of the reason that the Premier and the Governor got together right after that trip, because like you mentioned, you're inseparable just like the Yukon and Alaska, is inseparable. And so, Madam Chair, I really look forward to being on that trip from Seward to Ely and everything in between.
Anything else? I have a question for Lorelei to kind of bring her in. I'm thinking of Wishbone Hill and the rail. Right now, I think your plan is to do trucking the coal. If there were a rail line, would that be the preferred method for Wishbone Hill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to address Representative Tarr's question from earlier in the committee meeting as well, so I'll get to that second. Your question specifically on Wishbone Hill transportation, because there isn't an existing track now up to the Wishbone Hill area, that isn't something that we are looking into doing. It was part of our feasibility study. We looked at the three options of transporting Wishbone Hill coal out to Port McKenzie. The most viable option is still the trucking option. I know that there's a lot of other interest up in the Matanuska coal field with other coal companies as well as gravel operators where perhaps the rail option might be viable, but in the near term, which is when we hope to get our project going, the trucking option is still the most viable. Excuse me. But relating back to Representative Tarr's question, sorry, I accidentally muted myself. You were asking about our Seward operation and how that might affect Port McKenzie. So we would love to use Port McKenzie as a supplemental port for Seward coal. For Healy coal. We have no intention of abandoning the Seward coal facility because we already have existing infrastructure there, and there are certain benefits to the Seward port that we just wouldn't abandon. However, once the rail line to Port McKenzie is completed, we would like to use Port McKenzie as a supplemental port for Healy. Does that answer your question, Representative Tarr, or do you want me to go into anything a little further?
Thank you. I appreciate that. It does, and I guess some of the concerns I had were about, you know, whether the funding for the project, you know, at this time to develop the port at Port McKenzie would be a good use of state funds because there's already the Seward option and just trying to sync up the timeline of where things are going.
Sure, sure. Well, in my personal opinion as a Valley resident, I definitely think state investment in Port McKenzie is key. And from a business perspective, if you look at how our company operates, we already supply 100% of the in-state demand. And even if new coal plants come online, there is such an abundance of coal in Healy where we would be more than happy to supply that need as well. So the only way for our company to really expand is on the export market. So at Seward, we are almost maxed out on our capacity at Seward. So definitely Port McKenzie is an attractive option for us to be able to expand. And you all discussed a little bit earlier about the international coal market. It does fluctuate. We've seen these downturns in the past, and we are very optimistic looking at the projections on the international market that it will swing back around, and we will see an increase in exports very soon.
Okay. Thank you. And now, right before we conclude, I'd like to give you each 30 seconds to tell us, knowing what the name of our committee is and what we as a state legislature, is there something that you would like us to know, and particularly is there something that you would like us to do that would help expand your industry and what we can do for the state of Alaska?
Ma'am, I am happy to be the lead-off batter on that question.
Go for it, Lorelei. 30 seconds.
I would just say that having a stable regulatory environment is critical for our survival. We have to know what the rules of the game are so that we can play by those rules. if there is a constant change in the rules, it makes it very difficult for us to be able to plan ahead and sometimes very difficult to react. So we certainly appreciate your interest in the matter and definitely thank you for coming on the tour last summer and look forward to your help putting something together for your committee members this coming summer.
Thank you, Lorelei. Dale?
Thank you for the last comment. I'll be brief. There are two things you can do, bullet points. Number one, the Alaska Railroad has very few, very large customers. Do everything you can to support our customers. We depend on their stability, their growth, and their health to survive and to expand. So my answer would be, do whatever is best for my customer, we'll be fine. Secondly, of course, is the greater issues of the financials. We are going to face a difficult financial year this year and push hard into 2014. Be sensitive to what our needs are on the financial side. Thanks.
Thank you. Ralph?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ralph Samuels again. Infrastructure development, you know, if we can go more places, you can release the bottleneck. I think that I know that the South Denali Visitor Center has garnered some discussion, and I know that Princess has put in their own money. There's a Native corporation has traded out some lands, so it looks like all people are coming to the party on that particular one, and that grows the whole pie. We can argue with our competitors about how to get there, because we all know that Holland America is the best cruise line around, but we can argue about it. But more infrastructure on the ground here, it increases the pie. Be careful of targeted taxes, and then we have not fully engaged. We haven't been talking up the PTC issue with the railroad, but we're certainly aware of it, and you saw the numbers of the replacement and the wear and tear on the roads. But infrastructure development, South Denali, and beware of taxes which just single out somebody.
Thank you, Ralph. And Tom, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I would just reemphasize what I said earlier about corridors. It's really important to long range that you identify corridors and preserve them, and existing corridors, you absolutely need to stay on top of and prevent any disruption there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for all of you being with us today and increasing our knowledge base to move forward.
Thank you.
And with that, it is 12:45. We'll adjourn. There's no meeting next week, and I want to thank the staff that on my left and right. We're adjourned.